Today's Teisho will be on Case 43 in the Book of Serenity. Case 43 is entitled Luoshan's Arising and Vanishing. Introduction. One touch of the philosopher's stone turns iron into gold. One word of the ultimate principle transforms an ordinary person into a sage. If you know that gold and iron are not two, that ordinary and sage are fundamentally the same, then after all, you'll have no use for it. But tell me, what one touch is it? Luoshan asked Yamto, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yamto shouted, whose arising and vanishing is it? Verse, severing old entangling vines, opening a fox lair, a leopard covers itself with fog to change its spots, a dragon rides the thunder to change its bones, bah, arising and vanishing in profusion, what is it? How fortunate we are that we can be here and practice together in this beautiful way. This morning, when I was eating my breakfast, I was looking out the window and I could see the dogwood, and it had begun to turn red, and I could see the leaves across the lawn, and it's just wonderful. Being here in the autumn is really special, really wonderful. And being at Sesshin is really wonderful, really special. I mentioned last night that I have done a lot of Sesshins. I've been doing Sesshin for 35 years. And there was a time when I was actually doing like 7 Sesshin a year. And I really enjoy Sesshin. There's something about it that's a very, very special, really unusual. I don't know what it is exactly, you know. I have been very much engaged in the life of our community for about 18 years. And during that time, I have been doing a lot of sitting in formal settings, and so I have been. I was attending some kind of formal sitting 6 nights a week, and sometimes it'd be 5 nights a week, and sometimes 6. And we've been doing 5 sesshin a year for almost 20 years. And so, you know, basically I was sitting 6 times a night, 6 times a week, 6 nights a week, and doing all these sesshin. I realized, you know, maybe my life has become a little unbalanced. So a few years ago, I decided I was going to take a vacation, which is something actually I had not been doing for a while. So I went up into the mountains with my friend Larry Sullivan. We went up to the Sawtooth Mountains, and we went up to the Tetons on 2 different occasions. And I had a wonderful time hiking in the mountains. I really love hiking. And the Tetons are absolutely incredible. And this last year, I went to Paris with my wife. And Barbara and I spent 2 weeks in Paris, thanks to Mary's generosity in letting us stay in her apartment. And I had an incredibly fun time. So I'm very glad that I'm restoring a little balance to my life. You know, it was important. I love Zazen and I love doing Sesshin. But I was maybe my life was becoming a little out of balance. I thought it was a good thing to go to France, to go to the Tetons, and I had a wonderful time. And I want to go back. And I want to go back up into the mountains. I like to go to museums and things like that. This last weekend, I went to the museum. I went into New York with Barbara. We went to this show of paintings by an Austrian, a Swiss painter whose name is Hodler. And I love his work, and I was just so happy looking at his work. But when I got up this morning, I thought to myself, you know, I was really happy in France. Going to Paris made me really happy. And it's a wonderful thing to go to France. And I had a wonderful time in the Sawtooth Mountains recently, and also in the Tetons. But I was thinking this morning, you know, I really feel happiest at Sesshin. And so now I understand why I've been doing all these Sesshins, you know. Something about it really makes me feel very happy. And I feel very, I guess it's just clearing away the obstacles, clearing away the obstacles. You sit down on the cushion and you begin to find your barriers fall away. And then, you know, you're sitting there eating your breakfast and you look out the window and you see this tree. And maybe it's because we slow it down. You know, we just slow things down. Maybe it's because we, don't have a lot of external stimulation. Maybe it's because we're calming the mind, you know, but that when I looked at that tree, when I looked at that dogwood tree, I just felt a kind of unconscious connectedness that made me feel totally at peace and happy. And I actually enjoy going to the museums, but I don't quite get to that place. I just don't. And I like to go hiking, and sometimes I feel very close to that. You know, I get there, I guess, but not as deeply, you know. And there's just something, I think, very special about Sesshin. I think it's related to this koan, you know. Arising and vanishing. Arising and vanishing. You know, we are, one way to think about Sesshin is that we're trying to find a still point in a turning world. You might know that phrase. You know, that the world is just like chaos sometimes. It's just chaos. And it can be chaos in a painful way, or it can be chaos in an entertaining way. But then you come to Sesshin, and it's just like it's finding that still point. Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes we bring the chaos with us, and it takes a few days. But if we find that still point, it's really beautiful. It's wonderful to be it finally still and finally free. You know, finally still and finally free. And there's arising and vanishing, arising and vanishing, arising and vanishing. But we can come to Sesshin, and we seem to be at a place where there's no arising and there's no vanishing. There's just now. And that's really wonderful. So that could lead you to feel this way, that the world is a totally crazy place, totally crazy and mad and frightening. And that when you come to Sesshin, you're escaping from the madness and you're finally getting back to safety and stillness and all those things, silence. Now, you know, that is not a bad perspective, actually, to have on Sesshin. But it's not it's not really the Zen perspective. You know, that would be really what we would call maybe like a Theravada perspective. You know, in early Buddhism, people interpreted the Buddha as saying that the world of form is on fire and is a really frightening place, and that you have to renounce, or you have to detach. You have to detach, 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 detach. And so, you know, there's a lot of evidence that the world is a crazy place, and even a dangerous place. But this constant uncertainty really wears you down, and the tension and stress. And so you can come to Sesshin, and it's still, and it's peaceful, you know. And you can say, thank God I'm out of the fire now, and I'm in this cool place. There is some truth to that. There is some truth to that. The dimension of Sesshin is like that. You know, when I first started doing Zen, I was on fire. You know, I was really unhappy and confused, and I was nervous almost all the time, and anxious all the time, and in a state of unhappiness. And when I started doing Zen, even though it was physically very painful for me, it was wonderful psychologically. And when I went to my first Sesshin, even though it was murder for my legs, it was wonderful for my mind, because I really did find this stillness and peace, and it was so liberating. And this is, you know, people, I remember reading years ago, there's a book called the Theragatha, and it's poems by Buddhist nuns, early Buddhist nuns. And they say things like, I was married to a mean husband, and he made me work from dawn till dusk, and I never had a day without shedding tears, and I left that bastard, and now I live in a temple, and I do zazen, and I'm finally free. See, free. And others are like that too, you know. One said, I would go out dressed to kill, I would put on my makeup, I would do my hair. I was always trying to be a seductress, and I was so unhappy, and now I don't worry about my hair because I don't have any hair, and I live in a temple, and I'm free. Free. It's over, right? That's over. And there's some, that's really liberating. You know, that perspective is, that's a Theravada or Hinayana perspective, early Buddhism. The world of form is dangerous, deceptive, stress-producing, unhappiness-producing. And we need to detach, 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 so we come to Sesshin. And we detach. And indeed, we're happier. Really is true. So that's one way to understand it. You know, that would be early Buddhism. You know, early Buddhism was like that. Please detach. Get out of this this world which is consumed by fire, and be detached, be aloof. You know, Theravada is very strict. You know, if you're a monk in the Theravada tradition, you can never leave the monastery. Did you know that? You can leave with permission, but you're never supposed to really leave. And if you take off your robe and you put on a shirt and a pair of pants, you're out. You're fired. They're not allowed to do that. Genki Roshi used to hang up his robes and he'd go out in civilian clothes. He'd put a little beret on his head. And many Roshis do that. But that would mean you would be out of the Sangha in a Theravada community. So they're very strict. Once you're a monk or a nun, that's it for life. You can never leave the Sangha. And you can never leave the monastery. Any infractions are you're out, you know. So you're not allowed, for example, monk is not allowed even to touch a monk, a male renunciate is not allowed even to touch a woman, not even touch. So very strict. The idea is the world is polluting, and Zen is, well, not Zen, but the world is polluting, and Buddhism is about cleaning away the pollution, cleaning away obstructions and pollution, and getting back to your pristine, pure state. That is not our way. That's not the Zen view. You know, I don't know, I'm sure you've had this experience, but, you know, we have sitting at the university, a beginner sitting on Monday and Friday. And basically, we get new people, and they do Zazen for the first time or the second time, and it's hard for them. But I've had a number of people this year who came up to me and said, "That was hard, but, you know, oh, that tea was so delicious. What was that tea?" And I just said, "It's ordinary tea. But it's tea that you've drunk with an empty mind, with a mind of Mu Xin." So, you know, when you come in and you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath for an hour and a half, your mind becomes very clear and pure. And then, you know, when you have a cup of tea, it's actually delicious. It's really delicious. And I sometimes I go in and get another cup of tea, and the second one is almost as good as the first cup. Now you could say, you know, I thought we were supposed to be about renouncing, you know, and actually, when you do zazen and you have a cup of tea, the tea is better. You know, so the question is, are we really committing a mistake when we enjoy the tea after doing our zazen? See, and this is the difference between a Hinayana view and a Mahayana view. The Mahayana view is, no, please enjoy the tea. It's actually better if you have emptied your mind. But it's okay to love tea. See, it's okay to love tea. And so, you know, you drink the tea and you think, that is the best darn tea, right? So it's probably, it's okay, it's valid to say, the world is burning, and we need to get out of this world and avoid pollution and defilements, and be free. The Mahayana view, which came a little later, said, you know, that's actually a mistaken understanding of the Buddha's teaching. He didn't really want you to leave the world completely. He wanted you to clean up your mind. And when you clean up your mind, you can engage with the world. You can engage with the world in a different way. You can be engaged with the world in a different way, more open-hearted, more creative, and more alert and alive. So that when we drink the tea, we become the tea. When we hear the sound of the wind and we feel happy, we become the sound of the wind. So it's not a sin to enjoy the tea. It's not a sin to be happy if you're outside walking through the leaves. You could say, but you're getting attached, see? And the Mahayana view is everything's attached. See, everything is one life. It's all interconnected. Detachment is like impossible. In the commentary on this Teisho, they say trying to be detached from the world is like pushing a gourd down into the water and trying to make it stay under the water. And the gourd keeps popping back up to the surface of the water because it's full of air. Trying to free yourself from all connection to the world is an impossible task because you're connected. You're essentially a connection to the world. You know, you're like, it would be like roots trying to free themselves from a tree, or branches trying to free themselves from the tree. So the Mahayana has a little different perspective than the Theravada, view. The idea is we clean up our mind and then we can really enjoy the tea. So this is like stage one of Buddhism was take no joy in the tea. Don't get attached to the tea. Stage two was like, enjoy the tea. See, it's okay. Stage three was actually like the Zen of Matsu, the great Zen master Matsu. He actually said, if you're even worried about sitting, you're probably making a big mistake. You know, Matsu did a lot of zazen, but then he finally said, "Look, you know, you should be able to be you should be able to embrace the moment by moment as it's happening, no matter what it is, with a non-discriminating mind. And whether you're doing Zazen or not really doesn't matter. In fact, Zazen could even be an obstacle to you. Matsa said, basically, enlightenment is all about just embracing every moment with a non-discriminating mind. Okay? So this is like stage three in the development of Buddhism. Sitting or not sitting, just be with the moment in a non-discriminating mind. Okay. So that would be the Buddhism of Matsu. And that is the Buddha. You know, if you read books on Zen, you'll suddenly realize that actually they aren't all teaching the same thing. This is interesting to me. You know, there are Zen teachers who really just say, don't discriminate. That's the highest truth. They're sort of like the followers of Matsu, ancestor horse. They just, you know, just don't discriminate, moment by moment awareness, that's it. That is not the view of all people in Zen. You know, that's not, even within Zen there's disagreements. So Matsu Zen became very popular in China, and really the golden age of Zen was filled with people who were Matsu's students. And they said, don't worry about doing Zazen, just moment by moment awareness. You know, it's not necessary to sit, and so on and so on. And actually what happened in China was quite interesting, because around the end of the Tang Dynasty, and in the Song Dynasty, Zen collapsed, believe it or not. There was like a complete collapse of Zen in China because Matsu's teaching of just non-discriminating mind actually had the effect of weakening Zen and making it very superficial. So basically people were just cultivating moment-by-moment awareness, and their understanding became shallower and shallower. So there was a sort of reconstruction of Zen after the Song Dynasty. And basically the lineage of Dongshan, the author of the Book of Serenity, is like stage four. And Dongshan said, And other teachers who were in this reconstruction of Zen said, wait a minute. You know, the Theravada view is not right. It's world-denying. But on the other hand, you need to do your Zazen. You know, Zen is not just about non-discriminating awareness. It's also about the enlightened mind. It's also about seeing the source. If you just practice non-discriminating awareness, you will be a reasonably happy person, and you will be able to cope with your life circumstances pretty well. Non-discriminating awareness is not a bad philosophy, but it's not enlightened mind, in my opinion. And I do think that many people who practice Zen practice non-discriminating awareness, and they think that's the highest truth. But there are certainly Zen teachers who say that's not so. If you do a lot of Zazen, and you go into the depths of Samadhi and the depths of Mushin, sooner or later you will undergo an internal revolution. Like an internal revolution. And this is called seeing the source. This is a source, seeing the source. There's a source, consciousness has many layers, many levels. And one of those levels is, they have many levels. Discriminating mind, memory, imagination. As you're sitting on the cushion, you're probably going through all of those. You know, your memories, thoughts, on and on. Every once in a while, your mind becomes blank, right, or dark. and nobody is in any one place all the time. You know, you're in blankness, then you're thinking, then you're daydreaming, then you're sleeping, then you're daydreaming, then you're in blankness. You're working with your koan, then you're drifting, then you're working with your koan. Okay. But if you stay in that blankness, if you can get really down into that darkness, you are moving down through the layers of the mind, and eventually you'll encounter like the core of the mind, or the source of your mental activity. And the very core of your consciousness is called a dharmakaya. And dharmakaya is this radiant, compassionate awareness, which is the source of all other forms of consciousness. Encountering this face-to-face is the work of many, many years, maybe even decades. I don't know how many people have encountered the Dharmakaya, but it's a hard work, and it usually happens sort of by you stumble into it by accident, right? Just doing a lot of zazen. This is what's called seeing the source, or source consciousness. And this is really an important aspect of consciousness. But and really, this is like indispensable for a fully developed life in the Zen tradition. So, we practice sesshin in order to enter this very deep state of mushin. And sooner or later, people stumble into the Dharmakaya, into the source consciousness. And then, sesshin is over, and you go out into the world, and you have a life of, eating and drinking and going to parties, and so on and so on, going to the Tetons, going to France, going to swim in the beach. And these two things can seem very separate, for a long time. But the whole point of Zen practice is really ultimately to unify these two dimensions of human experience, which are only separate in our imaginations, the root consciousness and the consciousness of form, everyday mind. So a lot of Zen practice is getting to the root consciousness, and we have all kinds of obstacles that stand in the way of that, sooner or later, people, generally speaking, do manage to do that. And then practice is about integrating that root consciousness, the Dharmakaya awareness, in with your everyday, day-to-day life. So it's like two hands of one body. There's this root consciousness, and then there's like the branch consciousness, right? Which is all these little twigs and flowers and leaves of life, And Zen practice in its more advanced stages involves moving back and forth from those two conditions, right? So you're integrating branch consciousness and root consciousness, that radiant Dharmakaya awareness with the awareness of everyday form, is the work of a lifetime. But that's what Zen people are doing in the latter part of their lives. That's what it's all about. It really isn't the case that it would be good to renounce all form and renounce all worldly engagements and live in a hut and get your meals on a tray once a day and have no contact with people. In my opinion, that would be a very crippling way to live. And yet, for much of my life, I really actually had a deep drive to live that way, at least on some level. When life can be, maybe we all have these moments where, things are just so totally crazy that you just think, I wish I were living in a cave in the Himalayas, you know? And I would just get my little meal once a day, and I'd do my zazen, and I would have no obstructions, and so on and so on. And you think, I would be so at peace, right? And you might be at peace, I don't know. But, you know, I have had that fantasy a lot in my life. Sometimes things are not going so well in my life, and I still think, you know, I just wish I were a monk living in a monastery, and I would get up every day, and, you know. But this really does lead to certain kinds of absurdities, right? You know, where if you enjoy a cup of tea, is that wrong? You know, or, you know, actually it's natural to be, people have a natural desire to connect, you know. And people have a natural desire to be one with the world. It's really just one, it's fun, right? It's fun to go out in the snow and enjoy the snow. It's fun to look at leaves falling off the trees. You could say that's an attachment, you know. That's going to get you into trouble, that's attachment. You know, I think early Buddhists, I don't mean to insult them, but I think they were kind of like killjoys, you know. I think they had the wrong understanding of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha actually says in the Pali Sutras that there's two kinds of enlightenment. There's enlightenment sitting down, and then he said there's enlightenment moving. And he said, you can have this enlightenment while you're dancing. The Buddha says that. I'll show you. So basically, you can be in a Dharmakaya mind while you're walking around, while you're going to your work, while you're mopping the floors, you know. So this mindset we have, this world-renouncing mindset, is a really quite a false mindset. You know, when you try to detach, the attachments spring back. You know, if you try to detach, they spring back. And I mean, for monks, of course, this often takes the form of thinking about women, right? You know. So if you've renounced a life of a householder, you're not going to be married and you're not going to have a family, you have to be very careful not to be around beautiful women or you're going to start feeling unhappy, you know. And then you sit down on the cushion and, you know, you think, don't think of beautiful women. And of course you're going to think of them right away. And this is like absurd, right? You know, absurd. There are some people who are naturally celibate, like the great Morinaga Roshi really was, he said, celibacy is my true nature. I'm very happy being celibate. So that's wonderful. But if you're not celibate, you know, that's okay too, you know. What's confusing is trying to be a renunciate, right? Renunciation, detachment. I don't think Morinaga was renouncing anything. I think he was fulfilling his true nature. And so, for him, being a monk was really the way to go. You know, he really wanted to be a true celibate monk. And that was also true for Soen Roshi. You know, when Soen Roshi became a monk, he actually wrote little poems in which he said, I am so happy to be a monk. He said, I am so happy to be a monk. Happy, 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 you know. So this was his true nature, fulfilling his true nature. This idea of renunciation is mistaken. And so, you know, Buddhism moved in a different direction, although there are still millions and millions of people who follow Theravada. In the northern Buddhism of Mahayana and Vajrayana, people took a different approach. They said, well, maybe it's not so bad to like a cup of tea. You know, maybe that's okay. Maybe there's something we should investigate about our experience of contact with things, of connection. And that led into a very world-embracing mindset, right? But you can eat too much candy, you know. You can eat one piece of candy is delicious, 20 pieces of candy is a stomach ache, you know. So you need a kind of balance in life between stepping away and embracing, stepping away and embracing. Tea, after sitting for an hour and a half, tea tastes so delicious. But if you drink tea all day, after a while it has no flavor at all, you know. So I myself drink tea all day, and by the afternoon, my tea is really unsatisfying. I'm just drinking it, and it has sort of a vague taste, and it's not very satisfying. Sometimes I'll put sugar in it to give it some kind of flavor. But after doing zazen, you know, after stepping away a little bit of detachment, right? When I come back to the tea, it's really fantastic. So there's a kind of balance, right? A kind of balance where you step away and then you embrace, and you step away and you embrace. Think that Zen is about non-discriminating mind, I think that's a mistake. If you meet people who say, I practice Zen as a philosophy, you know, and I don't really do much sitting, it's a free country, you know, but they're probably kidding themselves, or they're not really practicing Zen. You know, it's a good idea to come to Sesshin. It's a good idea to quiet the mind, you know, turn off the computer, close the door, sit down, turn off the discriminating mind, and focus on the moment, you know. And really, it is true. In some ways, you are detaching, you know, so there is a truth of detachment. But on the other hand, you know, when you detach and then you connect, the connection is so rich and beautiful. But if you just connect, you'll find that you lose something too. So, you know, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, and everything I say you should take with a giant grain of salt, I think that the teachings of, Zen and Vajrayana are really, in some ways, like the most cutting-edge teachings in Buddhism. And I believe they're saying pretty much the same thing, which is that we should have a dynamic, a psychodynamic relationship with the world. And that basically, you know, there's a kind of a back and forth between letting go and embracing, letting go and embracing. And that in this dynamic dialogue, you know, we gradually expand the horizon of our awakened mind to include everything. So Zen practice involves, on the one hand, deep mushin, deep renunciation, maybe you could say. And you go into that blank place where there's absolutely nothing, and you have to spend a lot of time there in Zen. If you don't do that, you are not practicing Zen, in my opinion. So I think Matsu was wrong. I mean, he was a great Zen master, and I'm a little pipsqueak. But nevertheless, you know, I think people like Dongshan were right. You know, that you have to, Zen is not just about non-discriminating mind. There's something more to it. There's root consciousness. There's Dharmakaya consciousness. So basically, we sit and we enter deep mushin and we go to the bottom of the mind again and again. And that's like we're groping for something in this muddy water. You know, we're groping for something in this absolute darkness. And that's, we're trying to get to the bottom of the mind itself. At the same time, the other aspect of practice is embracing. You know, and some koans actually focus on groping blindly in the dark for the Dharmakaya. And some koans are about embracing, believe it or not. So not all koans do the same thing. Some koans are about experiencing oneness in diversity. Some koans are about experiencing diversity in oneness. Some koans are about going to the bottom of the mind. Some koans are about moving from emptiness back into form. So there's quite a range of koans with different, it's like a box full of tools. But all of them are trying to create this ultimately integrated mind, which involves both the stepping away and going to the depths of Mushin in order to encounter Dharmakaya. And then at the same, and then on the other hand, embracing form in all of its variations. And this is easy to say, but very difficult. Because, of course, we have all kinds of obstacles that prevent us from encountering Dharmakaya. And then, even if we've encountered Dharmakaya, we still have our personal psychology that makes it difficult for us to embrace a moment-by-moment awareness fully. We all have things we fear or that hurt us. But the fully functioning human being is able to stand still and move, to go from stillness to motion, to hold fast and let go. See, both things. Luoshan and Yangto are both monks in Dongshan's lineage. Luoshan asked Yangto, "When arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then?" So, basically, we go back and forth from form into emptiness and emptiness into form. This process goes on and on. And Yanto shouted and said, the question is, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yanto shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? In other words, everything is, for the fully realized person, the Buddha, he was the fully realized, but for a person who is, relatively speaking, fully realized, everything is like looking at a mirror and seeing your face, yeah? So you're embracing everything that happens without reservation in the Dharmakaya mind. So, my second teacher, Webb, trained at a place called Myoshinji. There's two great Rinzai training temples in Japan. One is Daitokuji, and the other is Myoshinji. Webb said that in the wash basins in Myoshinji, there were four characters, one on each north, south, east, and west. And the characters say, "I only know wholeness. I only know wholeness." See, that's the fully realized person. I know Dharmakaya, and I know form. And they're always a part of one life. I only know wholeness. So most of us can't say that. Sooner or later, there's something that stops us and makes us reject or step back. And interestingly enough, those wash basins were in the washroom at Myoshinji, where there's no heat. And in the winter, you wash your face with water that's taken out of the nearby pond. So the water is ice cold. So you get up in the morning and it's freezing out. And you go into the washroom to wash your face and it's freezing. And then you reach into this ice water and you splash it on your face, right? And the sign, the rim of the sink says, "Remember, it's wholeness." So it takes a little zazen to embrace that cold. So I only know wholeness. I only know wholeness. And by the way, the character for wholeness includes Chinese ideograms, the word wholeness includes the characters for feet, for your feet. So it's like being grounded on the earth. I only know feet. I only know being grounded. So sometimes we're grounded. That's good. When arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yanto shouted and said, it's your, always your arising and vanishing. It's always your arising and vanishing. If you feel it separate from yourself, keep doing your zazen. Okay, verse. Severing old entangled vines, opening up a fox lair. A leopard covers itself with fog to change its spots. The dragon rides the thunder to change its bones. Bah! Now, you know, severing old entangling vines, opening up a fox lair is part of practice, right? It's cutting away, you could say, renunciation. On the other hand, there's this other aspect of practice, which is a world embracing, right? The dragon rides the thunder to change its bones. And a dragon goes from the depths of the ocean up to the highest heaven and back with no obstructions. So letting go and holding fast. Arising and vanishing in profusion, what is it?